Welcome back. Robert Zimmerman with us, space historian. We're going to take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us this hour. Next hour, we have open lines here for you. Lots going on to talk about. Robert, let's finish up on the core, why planets have that molten core, and then we'll get to calls.
Radioactivity also provides heat, because even though, in a sense, the cores of planets are like small nuclear reactors. They're not stars, but the pressure and heat and the release of radioactivity also adds heat to the interior core. And that heat eventually will cause the materials in the center to melt. And, of course, it depends on where you are in the solar system. You get closer to the sun, you'll have more heat energy added to the system. You go farther out, there's not as much energy. But then the materials that are there tend to be, it appears, at least so far in our solar system, they appear to be materials that can melt at a lower temperature. And so you literally get molten cores of water and ice rather than molten cores of iron and nickel and other minerals you see around Earth.
Robert, would you agree that the formula, the primordial soup, is the same in the universe all over the place, and so that the rules of physics and science will adhere no matter where you go in the universe?
Yes, except I'll always add the uncertainty of science involved, because we haven't been to all those other places.
Mm-hmm.
But every piece of evidence we've gotten from, you know, looking at stars and studying the spectrums of stars and what elements are in those stars, and spectroscopy is very sophisticated and it really is reliable. It tells us what elements are there and what molecules are there. Yes, the universe appears to be the same, generally the same throughout wherever we look. What you do get, though, is variations within that primordial soup. So, you know, some places have a higher concentration of some chemicals and other places have a higher concentration of other chemicals. I mean, for example, there's a piece on Behind the Black about how they figured out why Jupiter's great red spot is red. And that's because when ultraviolet radiation and infrared radiation, cosmic rays, hit the planet, the chemicals in that giant storm are different than the rest of the atmosphere of Jupiter. And those particular chemicals break up into materials that are red in color. And it's cosmic rays and the sun's ultraviolet radiation that does that. But once again, it's because Jupiter, even though it has the same materials as everywhere else in the universe, the concentrations in different places are different, and the red spot has a different concentration of different chemicals. So, yes, I would agree, but, you know, once again, we'll find out with time. A good scientist always recognizes there's uncertainties here, and our knowledge is somewhat limited at this moment in time.
And one other question, and then calls.
Okay.
It seems like more and more comets are getting closer to planet Earth these days. Something going on here?
Well, it's not that more comets or more objects are getting closer to Earth. It's because we, as humans, are getting much more capable of finding them. We have much better telescopes, as we talked about right at the start of the show, about those two amateurs who were able to observe impacts on Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that impacts are going on more often in Jupiter. It's that we have better technology that ordinary people can buy and in their backyards use. You know, what those guys were using to see the impacts on Jupiter were probably equivalent to more sophisticated telescopes than what was available to the top astronomer 150 years ago. And so the better technology makes it possible to find things that we didn't know were there. And that's what's really going on. It's not that there's more of them, it's just that we can see them better, which is a good thing, because this gives us the chance to spot asteroids and comets that might hit us before they do so.
All right, now to the phones we go. As Vegas predicted, here's Bill from West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill.
Yes, hi, George. Yes, and hi, Robert Zimmerman. Hi, yes, I am an amateur astronomer. And I don't think I ever told you this, Robert, but first of all, I've had telescopes my whole life, but the last 3 years, since this time, 2013 until now, I have a very great 6-inch Meade, M-E-A-D-E brand, which I know you're familiar with, Meade LS Light Switch ACF Advanced Coma-Free 6-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain Refracting Telescope.
You must have a lot of fun with that. Look, I have a friend out here in Arizona who just, they're going to write this up in Sky and Tell, he just ground for himself a 32-inch telescope, making it, it's on a Dobson mount, built it himself. It's the largest and fastest amateur telescope ever built in the world by hand, and he grounded himself. So I'm sure you're having a lot of fun with that piece.
Yes, yes. Let me get to my two questions now. The first one is the expansion of the SLS and Orion spacecraft. You talked about Space Launch System Hughes rocket, particularly the 2018 unmanned mission in 2 years from now, 2.5 years from now.
Amazing.
And the second one is on the outer solar system looking for life, not only on Europa of Jupiter, but Enceladus of Saturn. So question number one, let me start by reading a sentence here, two sentences from Aviation Week in Space Technology from last month, February. It says, the space agency got an extra $174 million to spend in fiscal 2016 on the Orion Deep Space Crew Capsule, thanks to the omnibus spending bill Congress passed late last year. One change already adopted because of that money involves the crew hatch, which was not scheduled to fly until Exploration Mission 2, EM2, the first manned Orion flight targeted for 2023. Last sentence, quote, we will fly the flight hatch on EM1, that's in 2018, now instead of EM2 in 2023. So question number one, to speed up the Orion Moon Proving Ground for Mars program, getting to the moon quicker, 5 years quicker, instead of waiting to 2023, as in addition to world peace, and my thought is, why not have the first manned Orion, not in 2023, my goodness, that's 7 years from now, why not have four astronauts in 2018, since they will have all the life support system and the crew hatch, as I just read, on the 2018 SLS Orion mission without the crew habitat, but they could do an orbit around the moon with two American astronauts and two Russian cosmonauts.
Let me get right to it before you ask your second question.
Yes.
First of all, it is insanity to fly anyone on a spacecraft that you haven't tested prior to that flight. And in fact, NASA requires that SpaceX and Boeing, they have to do complete tests of every system unmanned before they're going to allow a human being on those capsules. Similarly, in the 60s, one of the reasons Gagarin launched and flew in space before an American is because we wisely decided we needed to do another test flight with a chimpanzee to make sure that Mercury capsule and systems were working. Now, what you're suggesting is that we fly SLS and Orion in 2018. By the way, that mission might be delayed till 2019, but we fly it in 2018 with people on it before they've even tested any of the system, any of it. That will be the first launch of that rocket. The very first time that rocket's been launched, you don't put people on such a mission. Secondly, you're never going to speed this program up because you yourself noted there's a five-year gap between the first unmanned test flight and the first manned flight. Five-year gap. They can't move it any faster than that the way this program is designed. Well, you can't ever explore anywhere with a pace like that. You've got to be able to launch often and frequently to learn what you're doing and do it right. This is a complete pork barrel waste of money. The only purpose SLS and Orion really has is to provide jobs to people in congressional districts. It really is a jobs program, and it's a fake jobs program, which is wasting the lives of the engineers who work on it, because they could be doing real productive work creating things in the private sector, and instead they're making believe they're building a space rocket and capsule. And I think it's a crime, and it's not NASA's fault, really, because NASA wanted to cut this program 5 years ago and go with private space. It is Congress's fault for pushing the pork on us and our fault for wanting the pork. We should grow up and say, no, let's spend our money wisely and let those jobs go away.
Second question.
That's my answer, Bill. What's your second question?
Okay, second question. I just was going to say we did have EST-1, the unmanned Orion flight.
That was not a real test flight for a number of reasons. For one, that was supposed to be testing the heat shield, but even before the flight launched, they already knew the heat shield they were testing was not going to be the heat shield that they're going to use on the capsule. They'd already decided to abandon that heat shield. So it was just
So why event. Even use that
In
then?
In addition, Bob? The rocket they used is not the rocket they're going to eventually fly. That mission was done for only one reason, to make believe they're accomplishing something and justifying a lot of wasted money.
I'm very
strong about this.
That's the bottom line. Bill, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
I would love to have heard a second question, but that's life. We got to get other callers in.
Sure. Yeah, they're piling up for you. Yeah. Let's go to Howard in Vancouver in Washington. Howard, go ahead.
Hello, George and Robert.
Hi there.
Good to talk to you guys. I'm old enough to remember the very earliest part of the space program. I recall how they went step by step from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo. And by the time the Apollo 11 came along, I was a young soldier at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I remember there were about 100 of us crowded into a smoke-filled room watching a little black and white TV up on the wall. And I remember that the stress and tension and danger was just palpable. It was, you know, the uncertainty, you know, was there. And it was such a dramatic thing. And today, when I talk to younger people about that, you know, they tend to look at each other, smile at each other knowingly, you know, like the old guy really believes this stuff. And I just wonder how you deal with that attitude.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with later generations becoming blasé about the achievements of the past. I don't have a problem with that, as long as younger people are coming up with their own daring, great achievements that will astonish themselves and the world. Going to the moon now with a Falcon Heavy rocket, that'll be in its own exciting, magnificent way. And I don't have a problem with that. The only thing I do have a problem is when the arrogance leaks to a point where they think they're so great, they don't have to accomplish anything. I don't see that happening with younger people. Younger people today are actually more innovative and creative and challenging than actually my generation was. My generation, the 60s generation, I think actually failed in many ways in accomplishing much. It didn't do much in space. We built the shuttle and we went around the Earth a lot of times, and that's about it. And then we retired it, and what did we get for it? I think new things that are happening right now are much more exciting.
But going to the moon was one of the greatest achievements ever.
Well, you know, as I wrote in my book, Apollo Genesis, the Apollo of 8, the flight of Apollo 8, they went to the moon thinking their chances of success were 50-50. So, yes, this is a pretty incredible achievement. I'm not poo-pooing that, but I look to the future. You know, a lot of Americans today get wistful and teary-eyed about preserving the launch pads and memorials to the past achievements. And no, if that launch pad could be used by SpaceX to put a new mission to the moon, I say tear it down and build a new launch pad. I don't want to make memorials to the past. I want to make memorials to the future by building new things.
Robert, what about other countries like India, Pakistan, China? Are they going to beat us to the punch?
Well, what we've got going, I have written about this now for the last decade. I call it the new colonial movement. You've got right now the competition is not just between private companies in the United States. You've got competition building between nations of the world, because they all literally see, and this is no pun intended, a vacuum up in space where there's resources and potential and wealth that can be obtained and territories, and they all want to get a piece of it. And so you got Russia, you got China, India is a player in this, they're a big player, Japan is a player, and then there's smaller countries. In fact, I had a piece on Behind the Black about how Nigeria is putting together its own space program.
Thought you were going to say a bobsled team.
What, say again?
Thought you were going to say a bobsled team or something.
Well,
that
it might be as realistic, their space program. But nonetheless, they're talking about it. And then you've got the United Arab Emirates has its own space program and includes they're trying to put together a mission to the moon. They've actually partnered with both India and Japan, and they hope to launch in 2020. They're serious. The technology is going to come from India and Japan, but they're going to provide the financing, and it's going to be a UAE mission, an Arab mission to Mars, orbiting mission to Mars. So, you know, you've got international competition going on for possession in space. And look, the Chinese this year, they're going to launch their second space station prototype. This is for testing purposes, with the plan that sometime in 2020, they will be launching their full-scale space station. And they're designing it as an interplanetary spaceship to learn how to travel to other worlds. That's their goal. And so they're a major player in this. This competition is only going to get more heated, and it's a good thing because it's actually going into space is a challenge, and it's actually a peaceful challenge. It raises everybody to a higher level from all the nations. The space race in the United States and Soviet Union raised both nations to a better and higher level. It was a peaceful competition, and it made both countries better for it. And I think the same thing will happen with the exploration of space. Let us compete, and then the competition will make every one of those nations a better place.
Can you imagine, though, Robert? I mean, we beat everybody to the moon, and we're 47 years still ahead of everybody. They still haven't done it yet. 47 years, a half a century. I mean, we were so far ahead of everybody. What happened?
Well, remember, the country was built on the concept of freedom. It was a very radical idea. It is still a radical idea. In fact, most, I'd say, a large majority of Americans today no longer believe in it. But it was that concept that made us the most wealthy, successful nation on the earth ever. And it gave us capabilities that no one else ever had before. And truth be told, had we had faith in freedom and capitalism and competition and private enterprise after the Apollo missions, and we allowed private enterprise to run things instead of a government program,
we'd be on Mars by now.
We would have settled the whole solar system. That's right. Yeah. We'd have already been having colonies, profit. I like to talk about how in the early 60s, AT&T was going to build Telstar, the first satellite to communicate between Europe and the United States, the two hemispheres. They built it themselves. They spent all the money. They bought the rocket to launch it, and their plan was to put up a constellation of satellites to provide telephone communications worldwide, far cheaper and more efficient than the underwater cables they were using.
They were way ahead of the game.
But they were forbidden to do it by the Congress and John Kennedy. And that a law was passed creating a government agency, a government corporation called COMSAT, which was going to do all communications in space. And by taking over and stealing from private enterprise, it shut down American innovation in space for more than a decade. And we didn't start recovering from that until the mid-70s. But think about it. If they had were putting a constellation of satellites in orbit in the early 60s, that would have jump-started the launch industry, and it would have created an incentive to lower the cost of launch then, not 50 years later.
Well, do you remember when AT&T owned all the baby bells and then they broke it up?
That's true, but you know, to my mind, it doesn't matter there because in this case, they were going to put us in space. And private enterprise was going to...
Oh, we would have been so far ahead of the curve. We're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment, Robert, on Coast to Coast AM. With our very special guest tonight, Robert Zimmerman, and we'll be back with Robert in a moment. We'll take final phone calls for him. Back with Robert Zimmerman, our final segment here. We'll get to your calls, too. Robert, when you started into this, when you were fascinated with all things space, and I'm sure when you were a little boy, what was that one thing that captured your attention?
You know, George, I grew up, like the previous caller, in the 60s, watching the space program unfold.
Mm-hmm. Like me.
And you know, kids are always interested in the new cutting-edge thing. That's what interests them, because that's their future, just like it is the future, but that's their future. And so space was the future, and that interested me. And over time, what interested me even more about it wasn't so much the technology, the specific technology, but the fact that it was pushing human experience to the edge, beyond. You know, the name of my website is Behind the Black, and the banner on that website is an image of some astronauts next to a rover on the moon with that black sky behind them. and behind the black, what's behind the black? And that's what pushing the unknown is all about. And it applies to men. To me, it wasn't just specifically going to the moon or going into space. It was pushing the unknown, going and doing something that had never been done before. And I found over the years that I get excited about anything that pushes the unknown. It doesn't have to be, putting a man on the moon. It could be something as simple as a new technological engineering development, like, for example, a program that wins at Go. You know, they recently had a computer program that beat a professional Go player. This is a Chinese game like chess, and a computer now has beaten a professional at it. And that's pushing the unknown, because you're kind of developing. And what was really cool about it was that the computer program was self-learning. It wasn't specifically just calculating moves. It played lots of games and saw which moves worked better, and it plugged that into its memory and improved its play over time, so that when it got to the professional, it was a better player. And every game it played with the professional, it was learning again to become a better player. Talk about data from Next Generation Star Trek, you know. So it's discoveries that interests me, and that's really how my mind has evolved over the years, and so I still feel that way. Anything new gets me excited, and it doesn't have to be in space, but space is probably the best cutting edge. It's the last frontier, always will be the last frontier. No matter what we do, that'll be the last place we'll be going, the farthest we'll go.
I got to tell you, everything captured me, Robert. Telescopes, microscopes, yeah. Chemistry sets, UFOs, rocketry, model rocketry, everything was great. But what really just drove me wild was when one night, on a very cold night in Detroit, I took my telescope out, a little 3-inch telescope,
yeah,
and saw the rings of Saturn.
Oh, yeah.
And that did it. I mean, it was like a picture painted on the sky.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it.
Oh, I had a similar experience in Brooklyn, New York, in my backyard with my little, very bad amateur telescope that my parents bought me for my birthday. I went out and I got to see the rings of Saturn, just like you, and it's like, wow. But, you know, over time, it's all exciting, and I'm like a little kid with all this stuff. It's just great stuff.
To the phones we go now. First-time caller Greg in Lakeside, California. Greg, welcome to the show. Good to have you.
Thank you, George, and I want to thank you, Robert, for your great reporting on Behind the Black. I'm an avid reader, and I'm a geologist, actually, out here.
Oh, so great.
We could talk caving for hours, then, I'm sure.
I think I just was in Tucson last week, and I explored two well-known caves out there with just public tours. But what I wanted to ask you about is, what really strikes me is the using the transit method to observe planets around other solar systems is just how we have to be really like looking at that solar system edge on.
Yes.
And when you consider that we've only seen the transit of Venus a couple of years ago, and then back in the 1700s, and maybe once or twice since then, is the odds of actually seeing a planet transit a star, even from here, seeing Venus, is so unusual that I'm thinking that it really biases our observations towards very large planets that are very close to their star. So what intrigues me is how much we're not seeing, because the odds of seeing anything at all using this method just astound me that we're able to see anything.
Yes, I mean, and this is actually a fact that astronomers recognize, that we have the early exoplanets were found by a different technique, and they favored exoplanets that were very large and that were very close to the star. So we saw a lot of what they called hot roasters or hot Jupiters, that are the gigantic gas giants that are orbiting just days around their star. And so the first impression is, oh my gosh, all solar systems are really like that. Well, no, that's just the bias of what we're looking at. We have only just begun, to paraphrase the Carpenters. We don't really know yet what the universe is like, because we've only really seen a little glimpse of those planets and those stars out there. And it's going to take literally centuries before we begin to get a more solid idea. You know, for example, we've only had really one good optical telescope in space, the Hubble Space Telescope. Really only one. Someday, when we have colonies on other planets, there's going to be lots of amateur astronomers with telescopes that may be as good as Hubble in their backyards. It might be, you know, in the dome. Well,
that's
think
cool.
How many discoveries, you know, like the two guys this week, they're going to start to find. So we've only just begun. Yes, we don't really know what planets are like in other stars. We just have a hint at that. And it's going to get interesting over time. There's things out there we don't know yet what they're going to be like.
Oh, and what about the multiverses, Robert? Oh, boy.
Well, I'd like to focus on things we can study. Not
I'm the same way, but, man, when you start letting your mind wander about other dimensions and other universes, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, I've been to a bunch of press conferences with, you know, physicists who get into these kind of multidimensional stuff. And I don't really like to report on it very much, because when you talk about the uncertainty of science, that's an understatement when it comes to that, because they're dealing with theory and just theory, and some of it can't even be proven with observation. I'm more into the things we can observe and see that we've never seen before. That's what I get excited about.
Back to the phones we go. Let's go out to Jeff in Hutchinson, Kansas. Hey, Jeff, good to have you with us.
Morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
George Roberts, a great guest.
He sure is.
I wish he asked him to stay for a third hour.
Sure.
Your choice, Robert.
Oh, I'd be glad to, sure.
All right.
Really, for me, it's only
okay.
Midnight. I don't go to bed till 1 anyway.
All right.
I heard about him talking about the 300 pounds of moon material that was brought back, and we happen to have a moon rock here at the Cosmosphere. Here in town, and I was wondering over the years what kind of accounting had been done for this moon material, quote unquote, and if any of this moon rocks have been given away to other diplomats or rich people, or do you have any idea?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. I've reported on Behind the Black a few times about this, because periodically moon rocks appear or are discovered in places they weren't known they were supposed to be. Someone has it in his house. A lot of them were given away, not corrupt for any corrupt reasons, but for diplomatic reasons, for honoring workers at NASA who contributed important things to the space program in the 60s. There is a pretty good accounting of most of these, most of the rocks. The sad part of it is that there hasn't been as much research on the material as there should be. It's stored away and protected with the idea that you want to save it for future researchers to use. But the truth is, by not letting a lot of researchers get at it, time is passing. Eventually, we're going to go back on the moon and getting more rocks. And at that point, we would have lost the opportunity to take advantage of the rocks we already got. You know, they seem very valuable to us because it's like you said, George, it's been almost a half a century since anyone's been there, so no more new rocks can't be obtained. But the truth is, they're just rocks. And eventually, when we're on the moon regularly, they're just rocks. They're not going to have any value at all except for geological research. And so I wish they were actually making them more available to scientists than they are to do research. If we run out of them, that's not a disaster. It's only an incentive to go back.
Well, next up, hey, thanks for the call, Jeff. I really appreciate you being on the show. And you want to stay for another hour, Robert?
You know, it's up to you. You know, you got your schedule. If it works for you, it works for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're not bumping another guest. It was going to be open lines. I'll do that the last hour.
Okay.
So,
well,
sure. You got the energy to stay up, my friend. We'll keep pushing you.
You know, I don't drink coffee because my metabolism is too high, even at my age. So I don't need, you know, I can stay up. That's not a problem.
Let's go to Daryl in California. Hey, Daryl, good to have you with us.
Hey, George, how you doing tonight?
Good. All is well.
Yeah, what a great show on this space subject, you know. That's really good. I had a couple of two or three things I wanted to throw out there to your guest, Robert, about that kill shot. You were kind of worried about it the last time, George, when you were talking about the kill shot. You were concerned about the sun killing our grid. That could be a big problem, you know, pushing the space program back. And then, two, that planet Nibiru or planet X, where it was supposed to come real close to the planet and do a U-turn and flip its debris tail into the Earth. And that might happen. It was supposed to maybe happen this year by December, and it apparently didn't because you didn't talk about it. And then in maybe December of 2016, and then the disaster may happen in 17. So those were a couple of things I'd like to throw out to Robert about his take on that.
Well, I'll be glad to touch on. First of all, the solar cycle. George knows this. I am not the doomsday that a lot of people are. I think that actually our electric grid has a pretty good handle on the solar cycle and the activity of the sun. It's not something to take lightly. You have to deal with it, but I think they're handling it reasonably well. And the real story of our solar cycle isn't the possibility that a solar flare will fry our electric grid. The real story is, and I've reported this on Behind the Black repeatedly and in magazines for years, in fact, I broke this story, is that the sun is not acting like predicted or expected. It's being inactive. It's being weaker. It's not producing sunspots anywhere near expected. And it appears it might be heading for another grand minimum, which the last that occurred, the Maunder minimum back in the 1600s, we hit a period of a little ice age. And the connection between the solar cycle and the climate is tenuous. It's circumstantial. They don't know how the two line up. We have never studied the sun when it was through a grand minimum, when you had no sunspots for more than 6 or 7 decades. We might actually have that opportunity in the coming decades. And if that's the case, we also might be facing colder weather, because though they don't understand why, they're the two link together. So that's the real story with the solar cycle. Now, the other question about Planet X, I've been asked about this a few times in a variety of things. People ask on my website periodically. There's no Planet X going to come hit the Earth or come close to the Earth in the near future. It's just not happening. If it was no Planet X being a big planet, we might find asteroids periodically that might hit us. So far, no, there are none. There are a few that in the coming decades might be an issue, but we're talking decades to hundreds of years in the future. There's one, Apophis, that's the most worrisome one. It'll fly by the Earth in 2026, and when it does, it'll give us a sense of whether it might hit the Earth 7 years. Yeah, 10 years later. But other than that, no, I know of no planet Earth X that's going to hit the Earth or cause any kind of problems. That doesn't exist.
Robert, we've talked a little bit about extraterrestrial life out there, and though you're not a believer that we've been visited, what are your thoughts on the possibility?
I want to correct you, George. I didn't say I'm not a believer. I said I don't see, there's no evidence at this moment. There's a difference.
Okay.
I'm very, you know.
So you're a healthy skeptic about it.
Evidence, and I want to see believable, solid evidence that is confirmed, and I haven't seen any. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. I just haven't seen any. I'm open-minded.
Have you ever seen any object that you thought was a little out of this world?
Yes, and it's one of the things that's made me so much want to see solid evidence. And I'll tell you the story. This is when I was around 16 years old. I was really into all this stuff, UFOs, and just all the stuff,
yeah,
you know, space and science and so forth. And I was wondering about UFOs, and there was a big thing in the 50s and 60s. And one night, I'm home alone, a teenager, and I have my telescope. And I'm watching TV, and I see some lights flashing outside the window. And I look outside, and in the distance, I see what looks like green and red and white lights rotating around something circular, a very small object in the distance. And it's not moving. It's hovering. I say, what the heck is that? It fits the description. You know, I've heard of UFOs with red and green lights around the perimeter of the saucer, and what is that? I get my telescope out. I'm looking through my parents' window with my telescope, trying to see this thing up close. I don't have binoculars, and I'm looking. I spend more than 45 minutes watching this, and it's moving slowly across the sky, and all I can see is these red and green and white lights seem to be going back and forth across the perimeter, and I can't quite see what they are. Is it a flying saucer? It's not moving like a plane. It's floating, and it's getting closer and closer, and finally I see what it is. It's a blimp with a zipper sign on the side, something like Eat at Joe's.
Oh. It kills it.
But at the same time, that's not saying this can't exist, that there can't be alien sources existing, but it means I'm going to look very hard at evidence, and I'm not going to take, you know, hearsay or light commentary or one witness report. It's got to be really...
Well, let me ask you this. Because of this vast universe, would you say it's highly probable that there's other intelligent life out there?
Sure. But, you know, until we find it, there is one thing that's really getting intriguing about, and I've talked about this on your show. You've asked me this question, and I've said the same thing.
I want to see if you change your mind.
No, my mind hasn't, because I haven't had any new data yet. The Drake equation and other aspects of it. You know, we have been communicating using radio technology now for almost 3/4 of a century. That will produce a bubble of radio communications moving out from the Earth that's almost 75 light years across. If there are aliens out there, there's a lot of stars in that bubble. Could it be any alien civilizations within that bubble? Could they have detected any of our communications? Meanwhile, we have been listening for 75 years, and, well, not quite that long, about 50 years. The early first SETI attempts were about 35 to 40 years ago, and we've been listening aggressively for the last 20 years. Not entirely.
I know. They're going to keep listening. Robert, we're going to come back. You want to stay one more hour, so we're keeping you next.